Right, welcome back to the podcast, Steve Sully Study. This is a first for me. Now, I've interviewed a lot of boxers and I've interviewed a lot of champions and I've interviewed a lot of ex-world champions. But today, Chris Billingsmith, you're the first reigning current world champion that I've had on my podcast. So thank you very much for your time.
Thanks
and
for
I'm
having
really
me.
Looking forward to having this conversation with you, mate.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's just always nice to hear the words world champion and nice to be a first.
Yeah, nice. I've heard you on a few different podcasts, including, I would like to call him a sort of a slightly mutual friend, obviously someone that you know far better than me, but he's been on my podcast and I've stayed in communication with him, George Groves. Really good podcast, by the way. There was another guy called Dodge, which I listened to that mm-hmm. one and a few others, and I think they were really, really good. Must be the first time you're doing a podcast at a London Mayfair Gallery.
Yeah, it definitely is. I was walking here thinking, am I in the wrong place? It's not a usual podcast studio, but lovely place you got here, mate. And I like art. I don't know enough about it, but I like a few bits of art now and again. So yeah, it's lovely.
I was going to say, and I said this to my business partner who's actually just left. I said, it's an honor to interview you because I'm a big boxing fan and I love the fact that boxers, fighters have got this do or die mentality and everything that you put into your craft, you're going to get the rewards off the back end of it. If you don't put the work in, you're not going to get the success. But I said, with Chris, he's known as the gentleman, right? That is your kind of stage name, your nickname, your kind of persona. And I said, it's quite fitting with the project we're about to launch because this is an Andy Warhol project that we are about to launch. And it's kind of it's slightly more sophisticated than your shadow figures that we have by Richard Hamilton or the other street artists. It's a bit more kind of refined and I feel like it's fit into your kind of persona, your kind of profile. The gentleman, it's not the gentleman, it's gentleman.
It's the gentleman.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought I heard on another podcast it was just gentleman, maybe I misheard that. Where did that name come from?
I was about 3 or 4 fights into my career and we were trying to think, we were like, you need a nickname, Chris. You need a ring moniker. And a few ideas got floated around and I couldn't really think of any. And then one day Shane just goes, sort of your nickname, Chris. I've just finished the session, come out the change room. And I said, yeah, go on. He goes, the gentleman. And I went, okay. And then his brothers enjoyed, like, yeah, that's a good one. One of them thought it should be just gentleman, like you just said. And then Shane was like, nah, it's got to be the gentleman. Because like there's nicknames been used obviously in the past, like Gentleman Jim Corbett, but because it's like a G and a J, do you know what I mean? It flows well, but Gentleman Chris doesn't really flow as well. So to be honest, I think it was just, my manners were good that day or something along those lines. I was very grateful to be in the gym, so I was always trying to show that to Shane, and maybe that's why he came up with the nickname. I like it as well because it's ironic because you can't be a gentleman in a boxing ring.
I was going to say this actually because boxing is not just about the craft itself, you know, getting in there and having a fight or boxing someone and trying to become victorious, whether that's knocking someone out, stopping them or beating them on points. The typical stereotypical kind of profile of a boxer or a fighter, maybe to a casual fan or someone walking the street, is yeah, the boxers they're aggressive, they could be obnoxious, they could be loud, they could be rude, they could be very vocal. But in actual fact, you're when you get in the ring, I wouldn't want to mess around with you. But as an individual, what I've seen online and the people I've spoken to about you, you're far from that. You're not a rude person. Would you say, playing devil's advocate to that kind of profile, could it hold you back building your brand? Because the likes of the Mike Tysons, the Conor McGregors, the Floyd Mayweather, the people that are really, at times, rude and in your face, that actually pays off later on because people pay to kind of almost see you lose or they're intrigued. Long-winded way of asking you, do you think that holds you back or do you think actually, no, it's better to stay genuine?
It might hold me back on the money side of things financially, because if you're a trash talker and you're very brash and all those sort of things, then those people through history seem to get paid more, and because they're more well known and they create more headlines and all those sort of things. But in terms of my career, it might have helped me, because people might want to fight me because they see me as timid or something like that. But I just know what's inside me and what I can do in the ring, and I've obviously shown that over the years now. But yeah, I mean, from maybe a promoter's perspective, they'd probably maybe prefer me to be more outspoken and more brash and all those things. But it's never been my style. So I can know when the day comes to retire, I'll be able to look back and go, you know, I was authentic throughout. And also, I think in this day and age, there's a lack of authenticity a lot of the time. And I think it's almost like an extra string to your bow being authentic now, whereas a lot of people, I'm very honest through my career, always have been. People have got better attributes than me, you know, I'll give them their props, even if I'm about to fight them. But yeah, it's I think authenticity holds a lot of weight now. You see a lot of people coming through trying to talk trash talk and do this and that, and it's almost like people don't want to hear it anymore. If you're like 5, 6, 7, 8, and 0 and you fought nobody, and people just try and do it to get themselves into a fight, and then they might stop doing it for a bit, and they might, because they're like dabbling in and out of trying to be that person. So I think a lot of time it can just be, yeah, like I said, less authentic. And I think yeah, that's just something I've always tried to be, is authentic and just be myself and just prove my worth and get to that level by the actual, you know, my actual trade.
On that note, we're sort of touching on maybe more like the promoting, advertising and the business side of boxing. You as a fighter, which of 19-1 now, current world champion, and looks like you've got some very, very big fights in the pipeline and a lot of goals to hit. Do you kind of really think about the business side of it now, Chris? Is it something on your radar where you're thinking, right, the next few moves I need to do X in order to get into this position because I can make more money, but also I can get to this place where I need to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's more, the money has now become more of a motivation, to be honest, because I've got a little lad who's be 2 in May. And I've achieved my dream of becoming world champion. Obviously, I have more dreams, but the step from being European champion to becoming world champion, as opposed to being world champion and picking up other belts, is a smaller step, basically, to pick up another world title than it is to just be European champion to world champion. You know, once you do that, you've collected the set. So, yeah, I mean, financially it's much more motivating now, and I'm aware of it. But at the same time, I've always just said to keep the main thing, and that's if you're not doing your work inside the ring, that's all that matters. And I'll try and juggle everything else outside, and if anything outside of that takes away from the boxing, then I'll just get rid of it or delegate it to someone else or do what I have to do to, or just park it for a while or whatever. So I always try and really make sure that boxing and improving my boxing and being a better athlete and boxer is always number one.
Do you know, like you've hit that goal, right, of becoming world champion? I said earlier, like, one of my favourite boxers is Floyd Mayweather, 50-0. And as I've grown older, I'm 38 now, and I've boxed. I've had 16 fights, not pro, but amateur, and then also for the, you know, like, unlicensed stuff and everything else. I actually now start to appreciate more and more and more and more, like Canelo Alvarez or any of these reigning champions going for a very, very long time without being beat, Andre Ward or Joe Calzaghe or any of these greats, how remarkable it is to go for that amount of time and have really good fights, come out champion, and actually remain. It's not even about like losing the O sometimes, it's just remain like hungry and willing to keep on pushing the limits. Because there are certain people in life, whether that's business, whether that's in boxing or something else, where they get to a level and their comfort zone kicks in, and they don't want the comfort zone to kick in, but it's just something that happens and they lose that spark. And I'm thinking, like, it's remarkable how someone like Floyd went all that time, over 40 years of age, and he's still doing it now with exhibition stuff, still chasing and looking to make a bit more money. Going back to it, you've got to become your world champion. How is the spark still there for you?
Yeah, I mean, the last fight, the Mastanek fight, was difficult because I'd had such a high from the Lawrence fight, from winning the world title at Bournemouth Stadium. Do you know what I mean? For me, it was just the perfect dream. So then I've been on this massive high, have some time off, celebrating, go back into camp, and like, they're probably not a lack of motivation. Like, in a way, there maybe was, but I was very motivated still for the fight. But all the talk around it was like, obviously, we'd gone to a smaller venue. Everyone's telling me I'm going to beat this guy easy, and looking beyond it, I knew how hard a fight it was, but just I can't put my finger on it, but it's just there was a slight lack of motivation compared to the camp before, which I don't know, maybe it's natural, maybe it's not, but I think, yeah, that I had definitely had a drop off there, but now I'm more motivated than ever. Maybe it's because I know my next fight's going to be a big, you know, fight against Richard Riakbor, and it's going to be another domestic clash, a chance for me to be, obviously get rid of the blemish on my record. So yeah, it's, the motivation is very much there, but people like Mayweather, and just phenomenal how he managed to stay so motivated the whole time. Yeah, it's crazy to think that he went on for so long, was champion for so long, at the very highest level. But yeah, I'm very motivated now. There's new goals. There's obviously the next fight, like I said. There's unifications. There's lots of things that that motivate me, but both financially and actual goals of winning more belts and stuff like that. And I'd love to fight in America, so there's that dream as well. So, but yeah, the last fight for sure was difficult.
Yeah. So you mentioned about fighting Richard again. That was the only loss on your record. And it looks like we're going to probably get an announcement at some point soon about that rematch. And it's probably going to happen later in the year, if I'm correct in saying. You're very respectful. Many would say you're very humble, your feet on the ground. But once you get in there, you do your thing. And it's great to see. There was a little moment when you were doing an interview recently where Richard was there, and I don't think you said anything out of term, and I don't think you said anything rude, but he perceived it as you was having a little bit of a jab at him, and then he sort of bit down. And do you know when you're in that moment where you're not in the ring, but there's a guy who's actually beating you and you're a rival now, and you know in yourself, and I could see that, you think, okay, you beat the old version of me, the new updated version of me is a completely different beast, and I could see it and feel it, and I agree with it. How do you stop yourself losing a little bit of your cool and kind of going after this guy?
I'm not really an angry person, I think, you know, and he was the one getting irate. All I said was, I think I said that Richard's improved, but I've improved more. And then he thought I said that he hadn't improved. And then just started going off on one, and I just enjoyed it. And just, I don't know, I enjoy those sort of moments where if someone gets really irate, I think just winding them up a little bit is good fun. Especially someone like Richard, because he likes to talk in third person and stuff like that. And he sort of tries to be this character. But yeah, it was just good fun. I never really, if someone goes at me, I haven't got anything to prove to anyone. I don't know where that comes from. I'm very content with who I am, what I am, and what I'm capable of doing inside the ring. I don't agree with violence outside the ring, so I don't think I'd ever get violent unless I absolutely had to. So yeah, I think I'm pretty calm in those situations anyway, but yeah, maybe it would be different if he went at me or something like that, but you'd like to think he wouldn't, being a professional and live on Sky Sports and all those sort of things. So, yeah.
Would you, I know you're confident. How do you think the fight's going to go in the rematch?
I think it'd be similar to the first fight, but I think the work I do will cause a lot more damage and just, I'm a lot more refined now. I was a bit hectic in the first fight, but looked a bit too, probably moved too much in a way in the first fight and was a bit too excited in a way. And I think now, I actually think his style now suits me better. He might have improved in a few areas, but stylistically, I think it suits me better because he stands there a bit more and sort of gives you a few more shots. So, I just think the work I'll do will just cause more damage. He's pretty tough. He's a pretty tough guy, but I don't know if I'm on 100% and I'm landing very consistently. I don't believe anyone in the world can withstand that if I keep landing consistently on them. So, I'm looking forward to it.
I think I heard you in previous conversations saying that previously you wasn't so much of a puncher, which is quite a funny thing for me to register because you're a big fella. Anyone who is like super middle and beyond is like everyone can bang at that level, right? If you get hit clean by someone at that weight, unless they're a complete fairy, then you're going to feel it and probably go down and it's probably going to do some damage. So how have you improved your strength and your power?
Since I moved to Shane, I mean, I had one stoppage in the amateurs in 43 fights, I think it was. And then when I first boxed Richard, well, I was 9-0 with 8 knockouts. So, yeah, just the way Shane teaches you is to punch hard. Like everyone in our gym can punch hard. And he just, the consistency and the lack of, he just doesn't accept mediocrity in technique, work ethic, power, like everything. So if you're doing it wrong, he'll just make you do it again and again until you got it right. And that's just drilled. He takes pads every day. Not all coaches do that. Some coaches might just stick their fighters on a bag, but every day he'll take us on the pads if we're not sparring, which is, you know, testament to his work ethic as well, and that's how he gets results, and that's how he's got results with me. He's just massively improved my punch power. Then strength wise, more recently I've got even stronger. Been working with a guy called Ben Carraway since after the Isaac Chamberlain fight, so it'd be the last three fights now, and just it's a new way of doing S&C, basically doing strength conditioning. It's haven't touched a barbell in that time. I haven't done a squat in that time, but he has a very specific way of training, and it's just helped me tenfold my strength, power, movement, everything.
Yeah, you got the strength, you got the I think on a Wednesday you do your circuits. One of the things that you don't really it's probably not your favorite thing to do.
No.
You've got the Versa Climber,
yeah,
and you've got all the kind of different things that you do. And I know those drills really, really well myself. The Versa Climber is horrible. It's like one of the worst, but best machines out there.
Yeah.
Then you've got your row running, and then you've got your pads, and then you've got your bag work, and you've got general skipping, and you've got all this other stuff. Out of all those things, how important is the regular sparring to become a world champion boxer?
Yeah, it's the number one. It's a skill sport at the end of the day. So you got to practice your skill, and you practice that best in sparring. And if you could only spar, you could get pretty much everything out of that, providing you don't get injured, which is obviously comes with sparring. You know, knocks and bruises and stuff like that, and. You can't really spar every day of the week, but if you could only do one thing for training, you'd choose sparring because it's the closest thing to a fight. It's essentially a fight just with bigger gloves and a head guard on. No cameras and no lights. But it's it's so important to get good quality sparring. And it's where you do all your learning. You might learn stuff on the pads, but then you've got to get into the position to be able to do it in sparring.
Yeah. I'm leading on from sparring to this question. Is it true that David Hay hit you so hard once in sparring that he ripped your head guard?
It is, yeah. It's the last time I ever sparred him, actually. It was before the first Bellew fight when he was with Shane. But Shane wasn't there because Shane was in the States with Carl Frampton. I just remember him hitting me with, I think it was like a left hook, right hook, left hook, went boom, 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 and like right on top of the head. And then I felt like, I was like, my head guard's come undone. And so I went back to the corner, I was like, head guard's come undone, can you do it up to my coach? And he's like, nah. I was like, just do it up. Like, he's like, nah, it's ripped. And he took it off and the stitching had ripped. Like, say there was, I don't know, 5 inches of stitching, 4 inches of it had ripped. And I was like, phew. So I had to borrow someone's head guard and finish off the spar. But we got it taped up after and got him to sign it. And because it wasn't my head guard, it's my coach's. And I was still an amateur at the time. And yeah, so he like ripped David Hay in 2017, I think it was at the time. So yeah, no, he could definitely whack. He was, you know, past his best when I sparred him, but still a phenomenal athlete and could hit so hard. And I was actually all right. I felt the shots, but I wasn't buzzed or anything. But yeah, it's always a funny story. People like to hear that one because I've never known anyone else to have their head guard broken. But he punched pretty hard.
There was another story as well that you was about to spar once, David Hay, and you were told that as you were preparing to spar him, he was sparring somebody else, a massive, massive fella. And you could probably give me the full details.
Yeah.
And he's clumped the guy, hit the guy. The guy's gone down and he's actually broke his tibia and fibia, I think, from memory. And then you were next. What was that for like? What was the feeling like knowing that Dave's basically murdered someone? And you're about to step in there with
him. So it's the first time I've ever gone to spar David. So I've been sparring George Groves quite a lot, which is obviously an experience for me. George's my favorite fighter, phenomenal fighter, but also he boxes at 12 stone. David is a heavyweight at this point, former cruiserweight unified champion, former heavyweight world champion. It's David Hay. Like, I was like, okay, like I'm going to go and do 4 rounds with him. So I've gone up there, I'm like warming up and everything. And I think I just put this guy before me was doing 4 rounds and then I was doing 4 rounds and so he got me second round there in. I'm like sort of getting Vaseline on, getting ready to go in, and I just hear this bang. I look around and this guy's sparring partner's on the floor and I'm like, oh my God. And then he's like, my ankle. And like literally about 10 seconds later, I realized like he's not going to be able to continue because he's not getting up because he snapped his tibia and fibula. And I just looked at my coach and go, guess I'm in then. And so that was my introduction to sparring David Hay. Pretty scary time. So I was very focused, let's put it that way, going into the ring. David mainly used me back then for just sort of speed and head movement and very quick hands. I was still amateur, so threw a lot of shots and moved a lot and moved well and had fast hands. So he very much he'd still obviously hit me, that's how he broke my head guard. But I think more for the sort of just moving his head and his reactions and stuff like that, because obviously that was a style of fighter that he was. But yeah, some pretty good. I mean, I only sparred David 3 times, 4 rounds I did with him on three separate occasions. But got some good stories out of it.
there's the obvious, like noticing how hard someone hits because of their punching and everything else. But there's other things that you pick up when you're sparring with people, or even when you fight with someone, or even when you just train with them. Like you get a sense of their presence in the ring. He was obviously a phenomenal fighter back in the day when he was cruiserweight, and then when he turned over to be heavyweight. I mean, how good was he when you shared the ring with David Hay?
Yeah, it was really, like I said, I'm not sparring even not just the best version, but the best version of David Haye, even at that time, because he's probably just using me mainly for just reaction work, but still phenomenal, still had to really, you know, just, you're always fearful, especially when the first time you go sparring, he's just knocked out a bloke who was like 19 stone or whatever. So yeah, very fearful of his punch power. But at the same time, you got to do a job and you got to land some shots, otherwise they'll just walk you down sort of thing and clump you. But yeah, still very, very talented. I always love watching David. He was stylistically one of the most entertaining fighters to watch because he was always looking to move his head and land big shots. And if he ever buzzed anyone, he'd just be jumping all over him, trying to get rid of him. And as a entertainment sport, that's what you want to see.
Yeah, I went to see him a couple of times in Manchester. Once against, I think the guy was called Ruiz.
Yeah, John Ruiz.
Yeah, and he knocked him down like 7-8 times. I mean, it was just unbelievable. Just absolutely busted the guy up. And then Aldi Harrison. And that was just a demolition job.
Yeah.
And he just, for such a big guy, and the way he can just spring off and just whack you, he's a bit of a freak of nature almost.
Yeah, he just had that fast twitch fibers and just reaction. I mean, that's probably, obviously had a lot of injuries towards the end of his career, but when you're that sort of athlete and that's the way you fight and you don't adapt it at all, you know, you're always looking to bounce off your back foot and bounce off this way and be elusive, not just stand with your hands up. And that was just his style, just so exciting and just a superb, superb athlete.
Yeah. Fantasy fight, Chris Billingsmith, Cruiserweight World Champion, WBO. And then you got David Haye, Cruiserweight World Champion back in the day. Who wins?
I don't know. It'd be a very entertaining fight. David could really punch, but I also really back my chin. So I don't know. It'd be an interesting one. David, you know, if he went for it, he gassed out against Carl Thompson. Maybe it'd be that result. But no, I think... I know going into the fight, I know David would be a hot favourite, but I've got a lot of respect for David. And yeah, it'd be interesting. Never been asked that question. Never really thought about it. But yeah, be better to ask Shane. We'll have to get Shane in. And he's trained us both. And maybe he could answer it.
The gentleman name and the gentleman by the answer, that was quite a politician answer, but I'm going to let just absorb that one and say, okay, cool. Just want to round off the conversation about sparring, okay? I've interviewed a lot of boxers and boxed myself, and as I've grown older, I always think more and more and more about the sparring. I interviewed a guy that you know very well. You've been on his podcast, a guy called Trish Dixon, who wrote a book called Damaged. And it was actually you speaking to him a bit more about the ups and the downs of sparring. And he was just saying to me, people actually think all the damage is done in a fight. Yes, there are stories where people have already got themselves hurt. There's lots of examples of that. And they've actually died or they've got brain injuries, etc. But the real damage is done behind the scenes when you don't see it. And it's not the obvious. It's not the cuts. It's not the bruises on the ribs. It's actually the proper concussion. And if you watch that film, Concussion, where Will Smith's in it, which is not about boxing, it's about American football, but the principle is the same. The blows against the head.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, you're a guy who's got your marbles together. You now got a family. I think you're about 33, mm-hmm. roughly. So young man, everything's intact. But the reality is, being a world champion, people want your blood. They want to come in there and hurt you. And therefore, you need to prepare right. And to prepare right, you need to have very, very hard sparring, I would probably imagine.
Yeah.
Does that ever concern you? Does your wife, does your family ever say to Chris, like, I know this is your profession, but I'm actually honestly worried about your long-term health?
No, they've never said anything like that to me. They obviously tell me when I fight, I take too many shots. Everyone says that to me. But I think my style, I'm going to, because I'm a come forward fighter and I like to put the pressure on, and I fight a real high intensity for my weight division. You're going to take more shots. I do agree that most of the damage is done in sparring. And I think, you know, if I was getting bladdered in sparring or buzzed in sparring and stuff like that, then Shane would be having a word. But that doesn't happen. We spar twice a week in full camp. We'd never, for me, that's what works for me. And we don't spar really until sort of 8 to 10 weeks out. If there was ever a concussion, there hasn't been, touch wood. But if there was, we'd definitely have a lot of time off of sparring. I've had a cut in sparring where I've had to have time off, and we don't take risks with cuts and things like that. So, but like I've read that book, and it's concerning in a way because it happened to a lot of people. But I think the George Foreman bit really interested me because he spoke to George Foreman, and obviously he boxed some of the heaviest punches in history, and obviously sparred him as well. But he's retired and he's very with it and all those things, and he never drank or did drugs. And I think that's a huge factor in brain health, because the amount of fighters that go and have a 12-round war, obviously you have a training camp, which is, you know, you're taking shots to the head for however long, and then you go into a fight and you have to make weight, and then the next day you're getting your head hit for 12 rounds or whatever. And then the amount of boxers that go, the first drink they have, I mean, at world title level and most title levels, you should get drug tested, so you can't exactly drink booze then, but amount that within 3 hours of fighting, they're having beers, and that's the only thing they'll drink for a few hours. They're not properly rehydrated yet because they might have had a bottle or two of water, so they haven't even rehydrated, and then they start drinking booze. And like, booze isn't good for your brain in terms of brain health, and getting punched in the head isn't good for your brain, and then you're marrying the two together, and I think the damage that can do is seriously worrying. Not to mention if any fighters are doing drugs as well, which plenty have over the years. There is meant to be a ban on no alcohol within 24 hours of a fight, but there's no way of governing it for the board or anything like that. So, and also you're not going to want to celebrate 24 hours later. So you want to live on that high. But I don't drink. I haven't drunk for nearly 10 years now. I didn't think I was ever a good enough boxer to be able to drink alcohol and improve in my craft and get through to a decent level. So yeah, I think that's has a lot to answer for as well. But also, like Trish says, the training camps will be key. And I mean, Barry McGuigan used to spar every day. He's told us stories how he used to spar every single day, and he's never drunk, and he's very with it. But he had an all action style. So, so there's always caveats, but I think, you've got to be careful. I think the amount of fights we have as well nowadays, you have a lot less fights. I'm fighting twice last year, two, three times a year you're fighting at this level max, and then you're doing less rounds in the ring, you're doing less rounds in sparring, and then obviously the sports science of rehydrating is better, with the electrolytes and everything now, and then also just more knowledge in general and health. And I think boxers now are healthier than they've ever been. I think they'll continue to get healthier. I think all athletes are. I feel like boxing has always been a little bit behind, but I feel like the nutrition, the strength conditioning, and everything that goes with being a healthy athlete and how to really maximize yourself as an athlete and a fighter, then a lot more people are doing everything now. Whereas I feel like back in the day, obviously you go back to a lot of the fatal times of when people got hurt in the ring and the tragic times of people got hurt in the ring, then they probably weren't living the life. They're probably fighting anywhere between 8 and 15 times a year. Which means they're probably sparring all the time and all that as well. So I think a lot has changed, and it is something I've thought about, especially since reading the book, Triss's book. But it's something that you know what you're getting into. It is a danger, but you just got to do everything you can to minimize that risk.
Mm. Do you know, it was a question that just popped in my mind as you were saying it about the alcohol. And, you know, I do agree that boxers and all athletes across all different sports are probably a lot more refined. There's a lot more science involved. There's a lot more knowledge. There's a lot more recovery. There's loads of different aspects that protects people but makes them actually better and has longevity. But then you've got Tyson Fury, who I think one of his fights, not against Deontay Wilder, but in and around that sort of time where he was just about to fight him, or maybe one of the fights he'd done, he turned around to Ben Davidson, who was like young, he had like 4 pints the night before one of the fights, and he openly said it. And he said to Ben was against it. He said, "My body needs this." And it's just like, I agree with everything you say, but then the public will hear something from Tyson Fury, which is completely contradicting what most people would say. And you're like, well, who's right and who's wrong? Because this guy is arguably the best heavyweight on the face of the planet today and probably of our generation. Is he right to go out there and have 4 pints before a fight?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've heard that story. I heard it was 2 pints, whether it's 2 or 4.
Yeah.
You've got to think, look, if that... There's always... I think he did it because of he couldn't sleep, right? So he's like, he needs it because he can't sleep because he's up thinking about the fight. So, I mean, if he's not going to sleep until the fight without those 2 pints, it's probably better, because sleep is another massive factor in brain health and health in general. It's the number one thing. But 2 pints to a bloke who's 19 stone... and 6'9" compared to 2 pints, someone who's boxing at 135 pounds, do you know what I mean? It's different. Like, the blood volume is different in Tyson Fury. So it's not going to affect him as much. I disagree with it. I think sort your head out so you can sleep the night before a fight. Like, get yourself into a good sleep routine, like, do it, like, that's how I live. But he's obviously a bit of an enigma in that sense. He doesn't really do things just traditional way. His character and stuff like that is obviously the sort of bloke. And look, you can't argue it, but that being said, I wouldn't say his best performances have been in the last few years. I'd say they've been declining, to be honest, and not just because of the Ngannou fight. Even I think since the second Wilder fight, it was probably his last good performance. And whether he's drunk all his career and then, you know, and he's done that more recently, who knows? But you can't argue with it because he's unbeaten, but the science and the data would say it's not a good idea. But like I said, if it's helping him sleep and that's the reason he does it, it's probably not going to affect him that much in terms of the actual amount of alcohol in a couple of pints compared to the size that he is.
You touched on it, so I want to talk about it. Fury against Ngannou. Do you think Fury underestimated Francis Ngannou?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he just underestimated him, believed his own hype, wasn't really focused, and the fight was how it was.
And in your own mind, did he actually win it, or do you think you could have given
truthfully,
it?
Truthfully, I haven't watched the whole fight, so I couldn't, you know, never like to call a fight which I haven't properly watched. Mm. Those sort of fights don't really interest me. You know, Fury Usyk would interest me as a fight I'd watch. Joshua Ngannou, I won't be watching. I'm not really bothered because, you know, if anything dramatic happens, I'll just watch it the next day. But it doesn't really interest me. I'm like, two people have boxed their whole life or done MMA their whole life against each other, and they're at the top level. That's interesting to watch. But it seems like a bit of a circus. I don't begrudge him earning money out of it or anything like that. Ngannou's never going to have this phenomenal boxing career. I think Joshua beat him on points probably. And if he pulls it out of the bag and knocks out Joshua, then maybe I'll be more interested in his career. But yeah, there's never been no story or build up to Ngannou's boxing career. You know, I don't watch much MMA, so I'm not really invested in him. Joshua, I watch him fight, but I mean, over the last few years, I feel like there's so much more that he could give, and it's frustrating to watch him sometimes. I feel like he's better, or should show that he's better than he is, because I think he's got more ability inside him. So yeah, those sort of fights are a bit, you know, wishy-washy for me. But yeah, I think Fury definitely underestimated Ngannou for sure.
Mm. And on the note of AJ versus Fury, if it ever happens, who actually wins in today's current, where they're at in their careers? Do you think it's going to be AJ, or do you think it's going to be Fury?
I don't know. I can, because you just don't know what Tyson Fury is going to turn up. You'd like to think he'd be very motivated for that fight, but then also he could get in Joshua's head quite easy, and Joshua could just, you know, just try and box him and be not. You've got to be brave against Tyson Fury. I think you can't just stand off him and let him flick you from using his range and stuff like that. You got to be brave. You got to punch in combinations, which Joshua can do. But it comes down to both of their mindsets. It doesn't come down to their physical attributes or their actual boxing ability, because that sort of is where it is, if that makes sense. But it depends how both of them approach the fight. And they've just got to, you'd have to just, if Joshua was absolutely on it, I fancy him to probably beat him.
Mm.
But Would he be on it? You know, the unbeaten version of Joshua going into like the Klitschko fight to me seemed like a much better version. But yeah, it's a 50-50 because there's so many tangibles for me, more mentally than physically.
Yeah. Talk about heavyweight boxing, right? So you beat Isaac Chamberlain, right? You also beat the guy who beat Isaac, which was Lawrence Okolie, to become world champion. And I remember when Lawrence Okolie, or I think AKA The Source, he was beefing Dillon Whyte online, and he was also doing interviews, and they were slandering each other. And there was this leaked footage, which I think came from Lawrence, or he actually posted it. It was him sparring Dillon Whyte. And I've got to be honest, look, it's a little bit unfair to comment because what happened before that clip and what happened after that clip, I don't know. But I can only tell you what happened on the clip, which was he looked like he was almost giving Dillon Whyte a bit of a pacing at that point. I don't know if you see the same clip.
I haven't seen it, no.
And now I'm thinking, well, if you kind of beat this man, Lawrence Okolie, quite easily, and he looked like he was pacing Dillon Whyte, and now you're saying about money is really important, you've got a family, this is your career, doesn't it make sense that Chris Biddin-Smith turns over and becomes a heavyweight boxer and potentially takes on the heavyweight champion?
Health's more important than the money by a long stretch. It's not, I wouldn't fight like a Joshua or Fury because they're just too big and too dangerous. It's not, and I don't care how much money you're getting paid. It's, for me, it's not worth it, especially with my style. I'm not exactly like the most elusive cruiserweight ever. So, yeah, it wouldn't really make sense. But someone like a Usyk, I would, because although he's much more skilled than both those guys, you know, he's a cruiserweight that's moved up to heavyweight. So any cruiserweights that move up to heavyweight, like, then, or a smaller heavyweight like Joseph Parker, he's not massive at heavyweight, you know, those sort of guys, then yeah.
Andy Ruiz,
yeah, another one. I half forgot about him because he's just, I I can't remember last time I was watching box. But yeah, that sort of size heavyweight, then yeah, I'd be much more open to. But like the giants division, like I wouldn't bother. Like your Joe Joyce's, your Zhang's, AJ, Fury. Like it's just not really, it's just not worth it. Like, because they're just big lumps. I mean, never say never, because I love a challenge. But as I'm saying this, I'm half thinking, oh, I would quite like to fight him or him. But no, never say never. But yeah, I very much doubt I'll ever fight the very big boys.
Yeah, because like you're an ambitious man, right? And you're still young, and certainly as in one of the heavier weight classes, you can have a longer career past 40, because it's been demonstrated a few times by a lot of people. If you do become undefeated and you, or let's just say from now, and you unify and you've actually ticked every single box, and then someone like your promoter, Ben Chalong, I think it is, or let's just say a Eddie Hearn rocked up, or a Frank Warren or whoever, and said there's 25 million quid on the table for you today. You got to step in there and fight whoever, you know. Are you taking it?
It's hard to turn down that sort of money, but yeah, it would depend where I'm at in my career, who it is. It's a real difficult one to know until you're put in that position, because it's all hypothetical. Until it's actually there, like, look, we are going to pay you this much and there's a contract, then it's like probably very hard to turn that sort of money down. But I don't need 25 million quid. I'd probably give half of it to charity, to be honest with you, at least half of it to charity. I'm driven in a lot of ways. Money's never been a driver for me. Money's a driver now, but only to secure a lifestyle that me and my wife want for our family. But yeah, it's not the big thing. Yes, I might never have to work again, but that doesn't even interest me, not working again. I don't, what's the point of having all this money and just, I don't know, living, say I've retired tomorrow with 20 million quid, which is bringing me in enough money to live for the rest of my life, do whatever I want, unlimited money. Like, cool, but what are you actually going to do with it? Like, if you're just going to sit on a beach, which most people think, yeah, I want to win the lottery, so we can just live on a beach. I'm like, where's the drive? Like, that's not life. That's not living. Do you know what I mean? Living is pushing yourself, finding out what you can do and what you're capable of, trying things that are hard, and earning money is part of that. Like, earning a living is part of that to a certain degree. And it's, yeah, for me, it's not never been like, I want to win the lottery. I never, like, I don't want to cash out on this massive fight so I can just sail off into the sunset. If I cash out on a fight, it'd be to do something with the money to, I don't know, help charities or something like that. Like, if I've got enough money to live the lifestyle I want, obviously everyone likes a nice lifestyle, but just having limitless money to just sit there and do nothing just doesn't interest me. I'm way too driven for that. And post-career, I'll be looking for, you know, to find something else that really drives me.
Mm. Talk about money. Saudi Arabia. Not my words, but let's say if you read something in the tabloids, in the media, sports washing, there's a bit of that being chucked around recently. I've got my own view on it. There is part of it which is unbelievable. I'm really happy for the fighters. There is a lot of people that I know, family, friends, and a broader circle that will go, no, it's wrong and stuff. But at the end of the day, you've got into a sport which boxing and business, like, I see them as almost the same sort of thing. Like, many businesses fail, many boxers fail. Many businesses and many boxers just about make enough money where they can just survive, and they don't actually really get to the top, and it's a massive battle for a long, long time, and everything's stacked against you. But I'd say boxing's even more dangerous because of the physical you know, attributes that that are involved. So if you can go over somewhere and you can earn 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 50 million, I would do it. I would do it in a heartbeat tomorrow. And I'm pretty sure most people that would criticize it would also do it as well. But then the other side is all the money kind of taking out some of the, like, the authenticity of the whole marketplace for boxing? Is Saudi money kind of ruining the kind of drive behind boxing today?
Yeah, it's a hard one because from what you see, the atmospheres don't look great. I got into boxing for atmosphere when I watched my mate box, who chanted his name. I was like, that's wicked. All your mates there chanting your name. And now I've been fortunate enough to sell out a football stadium and have thousands of people there chanting mine. So there's that. But like you said, number one, I'm really pleased the fighters are getting paid well, because it's one of them sports where you so many people don't. You know, you probably see. The problem is the ones that get paid the most and that can retire very happy with loads of millions and millions and millions in the bank, it's probably 0.0001% of boxers, maybe less. Realistically, as like probably one boxer retires on average, maybe one a year, probably less than that, but can actually have enough to live a very, very good lifestyle. Then you have like, I mean, Tony Bellew said it on a podcast, I think, or might have even said it when he was on TV.
He did, yeah.
That he only had his money in his last three fights, and that's
mostly against David Haye, right?
Yeah, that's it. And that's the way boxing works. And why did he earn that money? Because he spoke. David's very brash. He's very brash. They spoke into this massive fight. People wanted to watch it. But when you actually look at the fight itself, none of them were in their peak. And it was an okay fight, but really the atmosphere gets built in the 8 weeks before, and all the hype is the 8 weeks before. And I get it, because 8 weeks is longer than 47 minutes bell to bell. So people are more interested in the 8 week build up than they are the 47 minutes. And that's where the business side, like going back to talking earlier and when I was saying about being brash and trash talking stuff, that's where the money's earned, is in the 8 week build up. It's not earned in the 47 minutes. Once that first bell goes, you're getting paid as long as you don't get disqualified. So it's a weird one. So I'd never begrudge anyone earning money from boxing, because even if you've gone through the amateur system, you've paid your dues, like to get into a pro game. If you've had to, even if you get a leg up by being in the Olympics, like you've earned yourself that spot because you've trained super hard to get to the Olympics. So you've paid your dues there. But it doesn't interest me fighting in Saudi Arabia. And the only reason I would do it would be for the money. And I don't really want to be that person. And at one point I probably would have said, no, I wouldn't take it. But if I don't take that money, someone else will take it. And I feel like I'd do a lot of good with the money, because unfortunately money makes the world go round. But I think I'd be able to, you know, like I said, I've ambassador for a few charities and stuff like that, and I'd like to do something really good with that money. Not just, you know, yeah, I'll go out there and fight for the money and we can buy a massive house. Obviously everyone wants a nice big house, wants nice things, but that's my dream, isn't to earn all this money just so me and my family have got a massive, massive house that we can show off now and again to a dinner party or a family party or something. I'd rather do something good and leave something that helps people. Rather, so to answer the question, yeah, I mean, it's good and bad for boxing in different ways. I think because of it, fighters' purses are going up everywhere, including fights back in England, probably, because if people get offered a fight out of Saudi or a fight in England, they're just going to take the Saudi money if the English money or the fight over here or in the States is nowhere near that money, which, to be honest, I don't know the figures, but you hear some some mental figures where you're just not going to get that money anywhere else. So yeah, but the fighters getting paid well, which is important in my eyes. You know, they pay their dues and it's a brutal sport. And if you leave a sport without anything and no money as well, it's a sad time, which a lot of boxers unfortunately do.
Mm. I don't know if I know his name correctly, but I'm just going off of memory. I think it's Turki Alsala, which is His Excellency.
Turki Alal Sheikh, yeah.
Yeah. So if His Excellency Turki reached out to you, would you entertain a conversation fighting over in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, I think so. I think, like I just said, like previously maybe before I thought about it, then I thought, oh, no, I'd never really do that. But yeah, of course I would, because I just feel like, but like I said, I'd probably only do it for the money, to be honest with you. And saying that, you know, he might see it and not want that. But I've also known people to go out there and say the shows are getting better. The promotion of them, the way they're run, the atmosphere is getting better. It's never going to be an atmosphere for me in Bournemouth, because that's my people and my town, and you can't beat it. But yeah, I mean, of course, and saying that conversation.
Your name must be coming up, though. It has to. Like, being a current world champion, there has to be people that are running those shows, whether it's, you know, the people who are the obvious people, the people behind the scenes, they have to go like, well, who's the world champion? Like, it has to come up. So surely those conversations are filtering down to you and your team and thinking, okay, if I do a couple more things, I could be probably out there fighting for 10 or 20 million quid.
My name doesn't hold 10 or 20 million quid, though. I think you've got Jaya Pattaya, right, who's the IBF, was the IBF world champion slash kind of still is, but he got stripped because he fought someone outside top 15, but now he's refighting for the belt on the Usyk undercard, Fury Usyk. He's been out there and he's probably just getting seven figures in dollars. So, and he's like been the cruiserweight out there, and people see him as number one. Some people see him as number one cruiserweight in the world. So you've got that, but me against him, it isn't going to generate, you're not going to get paid tens of millions. Like, you might get paid seven figures, but you're not getting paid eight figures or anywhere near that, which obviously it's still good money. I'm not saying it's not good money, but just to say like, oh, you're getting off a tenth. Like, that's just, the ones that are getting paid the tens of millions are your Joshua's, your Fury's, your Usyk's, maybe a couple of the other heavyweights that are on the fringe. Can't really see any at the moment that'd be getting that. Can't imagine any of the others are getting more than...
Wilder.
Wilder would have been getting that. But I can't imagine any of the others outside of Joshua, Fury, Usyk and Wilder are getting more than 5 million, extortionate amount of money. But just to put things into perspective, like, so then you filter down another weight divisions of cruiserweights and it'll be obviously less than that. You got the light heavyweights, Bivol and Beterbiev, who are fighting each other for the undisputed light heavyweight championship of the world. They've been spoke about for years, fighting each other. Everyone's wanted to see it. I don't know, you know, I'd be surprised if their joint purses are getting 10 million. They might be, I don't know. But I'd definitely be surprised if they're getting loads of millions.
Yeah.
But look, it's good money. I'm not saying it's not good money. But just to, so this is my thing about the media and the big names, like, people hear about Joshua and Fury's purses and Mayweather's money and Alvarez's money, Canelo's money, and they think everyone's getting paid that. But the gap between them and the next and the world champions that aren't massive names like myself and stuff is a huge gap. And then the gap between me being a world champion and not being a world champion is a huge gap. And yeah, you only start making mega bucks after you've won a world title and had a few defenses and good performances.
Can I ask, and it might be a bit of a cheeky question, but it's surrounding this conversation, and I think I've heard you sort of touch on it before. It was more actually about split with like management, promoter, etc. I think on a previous podcast you said like, I think you might be on like 30. You split 30 of it goes to your trainer, promoter, etc. McGuigan, I think that's what you said.
25% goes to, I think a manager can take 25.
Okay.
A trainer can take 10, but Shane does both. So he does both for 25. Well, Shane and his brother do both. Okay. So they do both for 25%.
Okay. So let's just say you fought in Saudi and you were getting 2, 3, 4, 5 million quid. But you mentioned earlier about there's a big difference between the Joshua's, the Alvarez's to the other bracket. And then there's another bracket below that. So like, if I can ask, what is the highest amount you've been paid currently as a world champion? And then before that, before you was a world champion, just so we know and we can understand, what was the gap? What was the next biggest paycheck?
Don't really want to talk about money, to be fair.
Fair enough.
The thing is, money as well in boxing changes all the time.
Okay.
Let's put it. So for the Tommy McCarthy first fight, it was for the British, Commonwealth, and European titles.
Mm-hmm.
And I got paid £35,000 was my purse. But then 25% of that's gone straight away. So that's what, 20. So that's nine grand basically gone out of that. You're left with 26 grand. Sounds lovely for one fight. You know, if you're having three of them a year. Camp costs. I live in London. Rent in London is extortionate. I was paying £1,700 a month rent at one point. So you got to pay that every month. You're in camp for 3 months. You take that out of that fight. Then sparring costs and stuff like that. Yes, the money's gone up since then. But it's not... I think the thing with boxing, people just hear about the purse. And then they don't think about the percentages, what a camp costs. And look, I'm not trying to sound hard done by, because I'm not. I'm paid well now, and I'm very, very happy with how I'm getting paid. But it is funny how, perfect example, I was boxing on Sky Sports against Isaac Chamberlain, headlining hometown Sky Sports, first time. Went down to the public workout, come back to the hotel, have a bag on my back. Just walk into the hotel and a family of mother and father and their daughter were there. They're like, oh, Chris, hi, are you right? Can she get a picture of you? I was like, yeah, no worries. Let me just put my bag. We'll go inside, put my bag down. So as we're walking inside, there's a Ferrari parked outside the front. They go, is that your car? I just went, no. I think at the time I was driving around in my mother-in-law's Honda CRV, which was like 10 years old. Because we were just borrowing it. We didn't even have a car. But it just goes to show, like, just because you're headlining on TV doesn't mean you're earning mega bucks. But yeah, I'm not really comfortable talking about money, but there's a slight insight.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, totally fine. WBA, WBC, IBF, and WBO. Which one is more significant?
WBO, because I've got it. I mean, historically, the WBC people love to have. For me, it's whatever governing body is doing right at that time. WBC seem very, what's the best way to put this? Pally with certain people, and certain people get away with stuff and this, that, and the other. The IBF seem pretty straight up now. I think there was something a while ago, but then they've changed presidents and stuff since. IBF seemed very on it, and they enforce their mandatory challenges and sort of, you know, do things by the book. There's no sort of, for want of a better phrase, you know, brown packets getting backhanders or anything. It doesn't seem like, not saying that other governing bodies do that, but that sort of behavior. of favoritism. So IBF seemed very good. WBO seemed very good with mandatories and the way they go about certain things. If someone fails a drugs test, even if it's not with their governing body, they'll ban them, or if there's not enough evidence, they'll ban them and stuff like that. And then, yeah, the WBC have just been a bit, from what I've seen over the recent, like Dillian White was mandatory for however long, but also just other things, not that, but like, it's just, they don't seem as straightforward as, right, here's our champion, here's our mandatory, this is a failed drugs test, this is past drugs test, like whatever. Like, it just, as always, everything seems grey areas, or, oh, he's managed to avoid that mandatory because of this. And yeah, that's just the way it seems. So for me, like, whatever whole prestige is, the ones that are doing it properly from for me. But actually, on the grander scale, WBC, everyone likes the green and gold belt. It's a classic belt. You know, there's always a little picture of Muhammad Ali on it and things like that, which people like. But I mean, before you're world champion, you don't care. You just want a world title belt. But if you look through all the champions, the WBO, if you look through them all, they're all got reputable champions throughout the weight divisions. And looking at the other ones, the other WBO champions, very proud to be WBO cruiserweight champion.
Mm. You've probably been asked this question, and you probably might have even thought about the answer a few times before you was even asked the question, which is, having so many belts in boxing, do you think it creates a bit of uncertainty about who actually is the best? And if we were to look at the UFC in comparison to boxing, they're two different sports, but let's just face it, they're both combat sports, right? Mm-hmm. Has the UFC got a point where they've only got one world champion opposed to possibly four?
Yes and no, but I think they've got a point, but you'd need, I think in both sports, there's got to be a, the thing is, they are, we say sports, but they are businesses at the end of the day. So if you're making the UFC loads and loads of money, they'll whack you up the rankings if you want that. Like, and that's the way it works. You just keep winning, or they just keep you winning by fighting people they know you're going to beat. And that's the way boxing can work to a certain degree. Mm. So I felt that there would need to be a clearer ranking system somehow, which is almost impossible in boxing because of injuries and the way it works. And, you know, BoxRec try and do it with their, they've got like an algorithm, like, so you could beat the same person, have exactly the same records, but if you've stopped one person that they haven't stopped, you might be above them. Mm. Yes, that, you know, I think in boxing everyone sort of knows who's number one, but then when they don't, any divisions they don't, at the moment it's kind of better by Evan Bivol in light heavyweight, they're kind of unsure about it. They just need to fight each other, and eventually, you know, we're at the stage where they look like they're going to fight each other now. So it is kind of needed, one belt, but at the same time, it creates these unification, undisputed, is kind of, it helps build into a massive fight, hopefully. But the problem is too many world champions avoid each other.
Mm. I know you're not with any of these promoters, but in my view, just my view, the best promoters in boxing at the moment is probably Eddie Hearn and Frank Warren. I don't know if you agree with that statement. I know you're with a different promoter. Who would you say actually is a better promoter though? Eddie Hearn or Frank Warren?
Frank's sort of done the test of time, but Eddie seems very new. Obviously, I was with Eddie for a bit and he was very good. He's very good at what he does because he sort of self-promotes himself and then promotes the shows with it. I think at the moment he seems to be, I think he's lost his edge a little bit because he seems a bit over the top with some of the things, with whereas back in the day he used to be quite real. I'm like, yeah, you know, it's a good fight, and he always sold it, but he would never oversell it and under deliver. And I feel like now we potentially get in those realms a little bit. But Eddie's a very, very good promoter because he talks the talk, he does that. You know, Frank's more of a sit back and just gets the deals done and says what he needs to say and lets the fights talk for himself. But Eddie's more of a new age promoter. I wouldn't really necessarily say one's better than the other. I quite like these Magnificent Seven shows that Frank Warren's been putting on recently. But at the same time, Eddie's doing it, you know, the worldwide and stuff as well. So I think they're very different promoters and they do things in their own way and sort of both need to be respected. But most of the time, the best promoter is the one with the best fighters and in their stable. So whoever that may be, in depending on the weight division, maybe we'll find out because they've got that 5v5 tournament coming up, which is interesting.
Mm. And it's funny now, since they've been doing work with in Saudi, they've definitely become a lot more respectful towards each other. And I thought, you know what, I found quite mad. The first time they worked together, Queensbury Matchroom over in Saudi, that was actually the first time that Eddie Hearn met Frank Warren in person, which almost sounds a bit ridiculous and unbelievable.
Yeah, mind blown. Yeah, crazy that they'd never met. But it's, I think Eddie being on DAZN now and, you know, Frank's obviously with TNT. So it's kind of like TNT are against and Sky Sports always battling. And then you've sort of got Eddie on the app, DAZN, obviously a bit more global, but sort of not as big and prominent in the UK. But yeah, money talks, and they're obviously both doing well out in Saudi. So I'm looking forward to that 5v5 show, though.
Me too.
I am looking forward to that. I think it'd be it's on the Bivol Better Buy of undercard, isn't it? So yeah, be interested to see what weight divisions they choose and who they put in.
Mm. Last real thing, actually, Chris. I was going to ask you, like, your roadmap. I know, you know, there's a fight going to be announced soon for you, but over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, how do you see it going? Who do you see fighting? Who do you want to fight? What do you want to achieve? Where do you want to be fighting? I know you mentioned in previous interviews, like Vegas and places like this is all on the wish list and the bucket list to tick off.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one name I've got written down here, which I believe you fought him as an amateur, but yet to fight him as a pro, which is Chef Clark. You're in my mind, you're more advanced than him currently, but there's no denying, I feel like this guy's a real problem for a lot of people. I think he's a tough, tough fighter. I think he's very skilled. And there's that slickness. He's got a little bit of like a Mayweather, but then there's also elements of a David Haye in there. So anyway, a lot to sort of digest there because I've asked you a few different questions in one. But how do you see it going? Do you think you'll ever fight Chef Clark? And what's the goal for Chris Bill and Smith?
Yeah, the roadmap is Richard Riatpoor and then one of the other champions. I'd love Gilberto Ramirez to fight. He's fighting Arsene Gulamirian on the 30th of March for the WBA belt. I'd love him to win because he's my route to America. You know, I want to fight out there because I just want to experience it. Whether that's Vegas or LA or New York, you know, any one of those, you know, I'd love to just fight over in America and do a trip over there and experience that sort of a broad build up because you'd have to go out there a month early and get sparring partners over and get a house and a chef in and all those sort of things. And then obviously fight actually in the States would be awesome. It's Vegas, it'd be mental. Be amazing to be like fighting for a unification on like a massive fight undercard, whether that's a Canelo or someone like that. But yeah, it's they're sort of like the next two dream fights. Obviously Richard first. The second one might not happen. Ramirez might not beat Gulamirian. But yeah, and then look towards, you know, but then be looking at Jai Pattaya and the IBF or the WBC, you know, they're the belts I want to clean up in the division. So got to keep working and make sure that the work ethic, you know, meets what are the goals I want to achieve. So that being said, I think Chev's a little bit behind, and I don't really think about, I feel like once I beat Richard for a few years, and unless someone comes through quick, domestically I've cleaned up, because I've done, you know, Isaac and Lawrence and anyone in the top sort of top 10 I've either boxed or they've beaten before they've got to that opportunity, or whatever it is. So you have Tommy McCarthy, Isaac, Craig Glover, and back in the day, Lawrence obviously then beat Richard. I feel like out of this crop, that's kind of the timing wise, is that's me sort of cemented as the best Brit of this exact time. Obviously people are always going to be coming through, but no one else has really earned their shot at a world title yet. I don't think Chev might do that in the next couple of fights, who knows. And if so, then yeah, that'd be a great fight, and be great to share the ring with Chev, because we've got history. We boxed twice and haven't really beaten both times, so I'll get on with him. But I know Eddie's mentioned before that he thinks he'll beat me, so yeah, it's that's a fight that could happen for sure. But right now, that's not in my sights, because he's just not up at that level yet.
I really appreciate your time today, Matt. I'm going to ask you this one last question. So I came up with my own mantra a couple of years ago, because I run, I'm in sales, and it's all about positivity, visualization, working hard, etc. Mantra goes like this: be happy, never content. If I were to ask Chris Billingsmith, the current cruiserweight WBO champion of the world, what does be happy, never content mean to you?
That's how I feel, to be honest, right now. I'm very happy. I'd say content with what I have achieved, but not, I can't stop now. So for me, it's, I think happiness comes from a lot of things. Career is obviously a big part of everyone's life, so you've got to be happy in your career. Family for me is huge now. Making sure me and my wife are being the best parents we can, whilst we watch our son grow up, and helping him grow up and to his own little human, which is amazing to watch and be a part of. Yeah, and you know, and being healthy and happy, and having a plan where you know where you're going, so you can be happy with the road or journey you're on. And yeah, never content is always being on that road, and always staying on that journey, and never reaching the destination really, or at least, you know, you might have a few stops on the way, which might be, in my terms, when I eventually get to retirement, might be a little stop on the journey, but then there will be something else. So for me, that's what I guess be happy, never content means.
Good answer, mate. Really good conversation. I really enjoyed the podcast interview. Thank you very, very much, mate. And who knows, look, a couple of years time when you're unified and you might be in the heavyweight division, I don't know. we can do it again.
Absolutely. Cheers for your time, right, mate.
Thank you very much. Cheers, God Steve. Bless, and be happy, never content.